This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Make sure you stick around because later in the episode, we'll break down today's biggest stories in the Chicago area. But first, for many women, uterine fibroids are something that you hear about in passing. You might know some friends or family who have dealt with them, and you know that they're common, but usually manageable. But for others, fibroids can be really painful and cause fertility issues. Black women are more likely to develop them, often with serious complications. Take Brianna Johnson's story, for instance. The Chicagoan's fibroid was massive in size and life-threatening. And when she got pregnant, doctors advised her to terminate her pregnancy. That was until Brianna met a local OBGYN known as the Fibroid Slayer. In this episode of The Pod, I sit down with them both to learn more about that journey and how other women can protect themselves. At the table with me was Dr. Pierre Johnson, who's an obstetrician gynecologist at Loretto Hospital, and his patient, Brianna Johnson. Now, I gave a brief summary there, but I wanted the doctor to help us understand fibroids a bit better. My first question, what exactly are uterine fibroids and why do they impact Black women so severely? Here's Dr. Johnson.
In a nutshell, they're just, you know, benign growths. You know, we can have, you know, cysts on our fingers, warts on, you know, on our skin. You know, there are different things where we have benign growths, but these are much more problematic because they can impact, you know, fertility, can impact, you know, a woman's quality of life. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the bigger issue as far as it impacting African-American women more has a lot to do with a lot of environmental factors, I think, that we don't look at.
Like what?
So chronic stress, you know, genetics, right? So there are genes that code for fibroids, which all women have. So the misconception is that it's just Black women, but it's not. You know, white women, Asian women, Indian women, I've operated on them all. It just so happens that Black women have more advanced disease, meaning larger fibroids, more numerous.
Okay.
And, you know, to that point, I think, you know, diet, access to care, right? So, you know, a lot of times, you know, we just don't have that access. And so for Black women, you know, hysterectomies were the Black woman's appendectomy. Right? So, and 2/3 of hysterectomies are still performed in Southern states. So there's bias and discrimination that plays a role into that. And so for the women that, desire future fertility, they don't want to have their options limited. And so putting off care is not just being negligent. It's just more so just not given the options
right. To
be able to do the things that you want to do. And so to that point, with time, fibroids can grow. And if you add in all of the factors of, you know, just lack of quality foods, you know, chronic stress of our cultural impacts, you know, all of those things
play
into to the point of women being impacted, you know, more severely than others.
Right. And Brianna, before you found out about your fibroid back in October 2024, were you familiar with what fibroids were?
I was, actually. I have a best friend and a couple of associates that have unfortunately gone through this and had issues with fertility. So I was very familiar and very close to the subject before I found out.
Yeah, I can relate in the sense that I have not gone through this, but just about everybody I know has. Everybody in my circle, right? What was it like for you living with it, with fibroids? I mean, you've been very active, I hear, throughout your life.
Yeah.
So did any of that have to start to change?
I mean, it just from a fitness standpoint, I've been like a collegiate athlete for a very long time. So, I mean, it affected me in ways of just how I was carrying weight. I didn't know that until I knew about the fibroid that, hey, this is why, you know, I've been in the gym 5-6 days a week and I'm not losing the weight I want to or seeing the results that I want. And I have, like, you know, this protruding belly and all of these symptoms. So it was a struggle for quite some time, but I was adjusting to it. Trying herbal remedies and really just looking for options when I weren't getting them from the doctors I was working with before.
So I imagine you just thought that, you know, as we commonly talk about that lower abdominal area and how difficult it is and how challenging it is for women to get rid of that with just sit-ups and, you know, crunches.
Absolutely.
You were probably thinking, this is just my lower stomach being stubborn.
Yeah, gotta push harder.
Everyone is dealing with this. Yeah,
absolutely.
So tell me about when you were diagnosed officially. What went through your mind when you found out this is exactly what you were dealing with? Was there any relief in now knowing?
Unfortunately, no. And that's because of the way that the doctor's demeanor was in the delivery of the information.
Oh, tell me more.
I felt attacked in the moment. I had no idea. I knew what fibroids were. But the way that he was explaining it, he was basically kind of victim shaming. He's like, you have a really large fibroid. And first, this is new news to me. And he literally said, you know, how did you let this get so large? You know, do you know this might impact your fertility? He said, you may very well have to have a hysterectomy. Mind you, this is all in one appointment within the first 10 minutes of me meeting him.
Wow.
I'm a new patient at the time. This is new facility. And I hadn't had an MRI before, never had any background on my chart. This is the information he's giving
me. But you were expected to know.
Absolutely.
And do something about it.
100%.
He also dropped something really big on you there, the advice to get a hysterectomy.
Yes.
For women, that's huge.
Huge.
And that comes with, it means, you know, possibly not having children.
Absolutely.
Right? What was your reaction in the moment to that?
I was a little upset and hysterical. At the time, I had an older child, so I didn't really think about starting over just quite yet. But I wanted to have the option to hear that I may not have the option at all. It was heartbreaking in that moment.
Doctor, when you hear Brianna talk about that part of her journey, what comes to mind for you?
It is a reoccurring, unfortunate thing that I hear every day.
So it's common that
Absolutely.
Women are
absolutely.
What about the victim blaming part of it?
All the time. I mean, victim blaming from physicians, which is absolutely crazy, but also victim blaming for people that just don't understand. Even other women will say, like, how does she let it get like that? I'm like, the only difference between a woman with advanced fibroid disease and you is that hers just responded differently, you know, because you most likely have fibroids. And, you know, the fact that they grow in some women very large,
right.
That's the part that we don't know. We don't know why a woman will have a 2-centimeter fibroid and have it for 20 years, and another one will have a 2-centimeter fibroid and it's a 22-centimeter fibroid in 2 or 3 years. Mm. That part we don't know.
So, Brianna, we have good news. You're expecting now.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I understand you're in about, what, your second trimester?
Yes.
Okay.
About 22 weeks, coming up on 22 weeks.
And it's going well right now?
100%.
I hear, though, around 12 weeks or so, there were some concerns. So,
yes.
So walk me through that.
So about 12 weeks, I'm talking with my OBGYNs. Obviously, I find out I'm pregnant probably just a few weeks before that. So it's still all relatively new. And the fibroid kind of takes a turn in growth. It increases probably an additional 10 pounds at that time. On top of what it was. When I originally found out I had fibroids, it was about 12 centimeters. Obviously, not being able to get any MRIs or anything because I'm pregnant, we're just kind of going off an idea of looking at the growth. But at the time, I'm measuring my belly and I'm stepping on the scale and I'm gaining weight like more rapidly than it would just be just caused to the pregnancy.
Did that scare you?
It did. One, I'm just like, I don't want to put on all this weight, of course. But at the same time, I'm like, I'm asking the questions to the doctors and I'm like, okay, well, about how much weight would you anticipate that I should be gaining? And I'm concerned because if they estimate roughly 20, 25 pounds through the total, you know, cycle of a pregnancy, and I've just gained this in a month, something's wrong. And I explaining that, and then the doctor, now I go to my 12-week appointment, is measuring my belly, and they're looking at me and they're saying, well, the first thing she said, which was hurtful, was, did you plan this pregnancy? And I said, what was the reason for that
right,
question?
Right, what difference would that have made?
Exactly. She said, well, I'm just trying to estimate and understand the viability of what your plans are with this pregnancy.
And you were also told to terminate the pregnancy.
Absolutely, or that the chances of me to carry the baby were going to be slim to none. So I need to be a little bit more comfortable with the idea of termination.
Did you consider following that advice?
Honestly, no. I mean, I took it very heavily, went and did my own research, obviously looked for second opinions, but it was very hard to take in that moment, as well as the timeline. They literally gave me 2 weeks to make a decision and said this concern needed to be addressed very quickly. And I said, 2 weeks is not enough time to decide on whether or not I want to keep my baby or decide on, you know, my viability for survival in general.
Dr. Johnson, we're hearing that recurring pattern again, right? And it shows, with the countless stories that you talked about before of patients like Brianna feeling dismissed, being blamed. It's very documented at this point that this is systemic and it impacts Black women and women of color a lot more than their white peers. So I'm wondering, as a healthcare provider, what do you think your role is in changing that norm?
That's a great question. My role is just a personal role that I don't think everybody has. And, you know, it's just changing the mentality and the mindset, not only of providers, but also educating the community that have these issues, you know. And so it starts with education. And so when you are equipped and knowledgeable about your options and what's happening with your body and all of the things that can make you healthy or that can hurt you, you can demand better healthcare for yourself. You know, so as you sit down in front of a professional and they're telling you things that may not equate to the things that you want or that sound wrong, you can now advocate for yourself.
Right.
But it all starts with education. So that's first and foremost what my job is to educate people and then be an example for all the providers, and not only be an example for them, but being an example for the patient. So using my platform to show that you have so many different options, and you don't have to accept bad things that people are telling you. You don't have to do that.
So the million-dollar question, Dr. Johnson, how did you fix this? Why did they call you the fibroid slayer?
I am a fibroid slayer because I take every case. I don't turn down any case. It doesn't matter how big the fibroid is. It doesn't matter how complex the case. I've made a point of always taking each and every single case. Mm-hmm. And through that, I've gained an experience. Not only experience, I've created techniques of doing things that are very unique. And then so I can navigate pretty much any situation. Mm. So
you did surgery on Brianna about a month or so ago?
Yes. And so when I heard her story in the beginning, you know, it was first I didn't believe it at first, because for me, I've been, you know, I do fibroid surgeries exclusively. And typically when a woman has massive fibroids, there are infertility issues. This is the first case that I've seen where she's pregnant and has such a problem with fibroids. It's not to say that women with fibroids can't get pregnant, because that happens all the time.
Right.
Women can have babies and have successful pregnancies with fibroids, but when it's excessively massive like that.
The size of Brianna's
absolutely.
Was...
You know, my biggest fibroid to date before Brianna was 20 pounds. And so...
And Brianna's was
27 pounds. So to see that... The new complexity of it was, how do I do this surgery in the exact same way that I always do it, but then at the same point preserve her pregnancy?
Mm. So you had to approach this one a little bit differently.
Yes, and just keep it in mind of that I couldn't be extremely aggressive with the uterus in of itself because there's a living being in there. But at the same point, provide her with the exact same minimally invasive approach to where she didn't have to have a big vertical incision going up from her privates to her chest, which she would have had if, you know, if another doctor that is not accustomed to this would have done. Still doing it that way, and at the same point, being able to minimize her blood loss. And also preserve this pregnancy through that incision.
Keep that baby healthy throughout Absolutely. The process. So how are you feeling right now? You're sitting in front of me. You look rosy.
Thank you.
You look great.
I feel great.
Yeah.
You're glowing. I feel amazing. Thank you. I mean, immediately afterwards, there's this huge relief, right? I'm 27 pounds lighter. I'm feeling happy. You know, I woke up. Get to see my family and everything, and it just feels like a whole new lease on life. Mm-hmm. They're checking on the baby. Baby's heart rate's up.
Are they doing more monitoring now, I imagine?
About the same.
Okay.
So I was seeing maternal fetal medicine before, so now I'm probably seeing them every couple weeks to a month, but just had an appointment on the 16th. Everything's amazing. I'll find out what the baby is next week. We'll have our gender reveal and
nice.
Everything's great. The baby is just bouncing. I'm getting all the kicks and everything now in the last
week.
Sounded
like a typical pregnancy.
Absolutely. It feels like it's completely normal, like just like it was my first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, doctor, there's a lot of women dealing with this, as we've talked about. A lot of them listening to us right now. Some may or may not know for sure that that is their particular issue. What is your message to them?
My message to them is that you have answers. You know, there's a lot of misconceptions amongst providers. There's a lot of inexperience. There's a lack of empathy across the board. But there are answers. And, you know, what I really pride myself on is this showing them that there's answers. There's always hope.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you have, I promise you I've done a case that's worse. And so, and for women that, you know, think that you can't get pregnant or can't have babies with, you know, with fibroids, I said, you know, look at Brianna. Like, it doesn't get more severe than that. And so if there's hope for her, there's hope for you. And you just have to really advocate for yourself and be knowledgeable about, you know, your options.
Yeah. Dr. Pierre Johnson is an obstetrician gynecologist at Loretto Hospital. And Brianna Johnson is a Chicagoan who's also one of his patients. Congrats again, Brianna.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Time now for a look at the top stories of the day in Chicago and Illinois. From a town hall where Black residents got to speak up to city officials about reparations, to what Chicagoans can do to help mitigate flooding in their neighborhoods, to an update from the courtroom of some cases tied to Operation Midway Blitz. At the table was Claire Lane, WBEZ's Morning Edition anchor, Summer Van Benton, WBEZ reporter, and John Seidel, Chicago Sun-Times federal courts reporter. We're fresh off Earth Day, and we're learning more about air quality in Chicago. So first up, Claire paints that picture for us.
Chicago's air quality among the worst in the U.S. That's the latest. The American Lung Association releases a report every year. The state of the air gave the Chicago-Naperville metro area literally an F grade.
Wow.
Ranking us the 15th most polluted in the nation. This is for ozone pollution. So data show that our region experienced 18 days of unhealthy air quality in 2025, which is actually just three fewer days than in 2024. And I don't know if you guys remember earlier in 2024, those smoggy days when we were actually told to wear masks.
Mm-hmm.
If we were going to
oh,
be
yes.
out, some people were told if you know are susceptible, that kind of thing, to stay inside altogether.
Right.
So we're seeing this data realized now. And some of this data from American Lung Association.
Yeah. Oh boy. So you know, and it's funny because you bring up that time with the smog in the air. you know, you would think that the air quality being bad was sort of just that time, but no, it's kind of an ongoing
thing
here in the city.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh boy. John, earlier this week, we covered how the town of Broadview is still reeling after Operation Midway Blitz. And you've got the very latest, I hear, on four people that were accused of conspiracy to impede a federal agent during the protests that we saw outside of the ICE facility in the village. Remind us who the Broadview, well, once Broadview 6, mm-hmm. now 4, are.
Yeah, I think we're still trying to workshop that nickname, but
dwindling the number as they fall off.
So originally 6 people were charged in this case, largely people involved in local Democratic politics. You've got the former congressional candidate, Kat Abu-Ghazaleh. Brian Straw is an Oak Park Village trustee. You also have Michael Rabbit, who's a Democratic committee person, Andre Martin, who was a member of Abu-Ghazaleh's campaign staff. There were two others, Kat Sharp, who ran for Cook County Board, and Jocelyn Walsh, a musician. Mm-hmm. Kat Sharp and Jocelyn Walsh, they were the two dismissed from the case. That's how you go from the Broadview 6 down to the Broadview 4. But this group is accused of a conspiracy to impede an agent outside the Broadview facility. It's one of the last currently pending prosecutions tied to Midway Blitz.
Mm. Yeah, the feds plan to use protest chants to prosecute them. I mean, is that likely to hold up in court?
You know, I don't know. That's going to be up to Judge April Perry, who presides over the case. But we're going to see. Like these First Amendment and free speech issues have been swirling around this case from the day it was charged. Is this an effort to criminalize First Amendment activity? What occurred was they were out there, they were protesting in late September against ICE actions. An ICE agent drove his SUV toward the facility, mm-hmm. and a very large group, not just these 6 people, but a very large group surrounded it, pushed it, scratched it. And so that's where you get this conspiracy to impede the agent.
I see. And the timeline for that court hearing, what's next?
Well, we got a pretrial, I think, on May 13th. That's probably when the judge will hear a lot of these issues and perhaps rule. And then a trial, I believe, is set for May 26th.
We should note that April Perry has, you know, she's got a track record a little bit now covering Midway Blitz overall. She was the one who dismissed the appeal earlier this week, wasn't she?
She was the judge who handled the National Guard litigation, yeah. which I think you're referring to. So in the fall, she originally blocked President Trump's efforts to deploy the Guard
into
Chicago. That was the case that went all the way to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court sided with her and refused to undo her stay.
And had some firm words to go with her.
She really did. She had lots of questions. I think that ruling really came down to the credibility of Homeland Security at the time. She was one of the first judges here in Chicago to really question it.
Right. Now, Summer, you were at a town hall last night. This was for Repair Chicago. Mm-hmm. It's a citywide community engagement push to hear from Black residents to inform a city study of reparations. Tell us a bit more about Repair Chicago.
Yeah, that's spot on. So back in 2024, let me back up. This effort really started in 2019 with Chicago and Evanston. Evanston has moved as far as giving out funds in reparations. Now in 2024, we have the creation of Repair Chicago, which, as you mentioned, is a citywide task force intended to explore the impacts of systemic harm on Black Chicagoans, but also understanding what reparations could look like. And that's what we saw at the town hall yesterday. The intent for this Repair Chicago group is to do a number of surveys, bus tours, discussion panels, hearings to gather that information, mm-hmm. and then deliver a report that should come out sometime in May or June.
I want to hear from someone that you spoke with last night. This is Beatrice Boyce, and she's talking here about her hopes for what can come from this effort.
We start local. We get the legislation. We get the politicians behind us. We get the people to stand up and stand for what's right, justice for us, repair for us. They have to repair the harm that's been done in this city. And then you spread that abroad federally and nationally.
So what else should we know about what happened last night and what's going to come next?
Yeah. So Ms. Boyce really emphasized this concept of local reparations movements, tackling the concept of reparations on a local scale, which you heard a little bit just now. Last night, about 100 Chicagoans from the North, South, and West sides attended. It was at Malcolm X College. And they discussed their definition of reparations. They unpacked it, combed through it, added to it, subtracted from it. And they also decided or thought of ways that reparations could be given to Chicagoans.
Right.
Anything from creating and investing in third spaces for residents and youth, housing and property relief for Black Chicagoans, free health care or free education.
Or straight up cash.
Straight up cash.
Yeah. Write the check.
You know, they explored a range of ways in which Chicagoans could receive reparations because, you know, we have this 40 acres and a mule concept.
Right.
But what does that look like in 2026 in modern times? So they're really trying to be thorough in how they explore this. Now, what does a timeline look like? That is, you know, they're already a little bit behind.
More to be seen.
But more to continue. There's a state hearing actually on Saturday. And next week there are a series of events, more panel discussions, more events, more hearings. So we shall see.
Much more to discuss there. And Claire, you had a great interview on Morning Edition today with Sun-Times environmental reporter Brett Chase. If folks were listening about 15 minutes ago, we heard it again. It's about flooding in Chicago, why it's increasing, what we can all do about it. What were the big takeaways from Brett?
Yeah, Brett did a tremendous job talking with residents who were impacted by flooding. He calls them flood survivors, also leaders in the Water Reclamation District, looked at some green initiatives to help with flooding, like creating man-made marshes, you know, or grassy areas that would essentially be able to absorb a lot of this water more easily. What was really interesting is this deep tunnel project that initially was touted as sort of a fix-all to this massive tunnel system underground designed just to soak up all the excess water, sending it into these giant wet reservoirs in the suburbs. But Brett sort of found that it's a flawed system and gets easily overwhelmed, especially even last week when we were just sort of getting hammered with rain. The system is designed to catch only 2 inches of rain in a 24-hour period. But we're seeing storms due to climate change that can drop more than 8.5 inches of water.
Wow.
So the water doesn't even have a chance to get to these reservoirs, which was kind of interesting. Also, you know, Brett looked at some of the data, some of the numbers, that all communities are at risk of flooding. We saw the north side get hit pretty hard recently. But some recent analysis found that between 07 and 2016, 96% of some of this federal flood disaster claims were coming from communities of color.
Wow.
So that's the west sides and the south sides over the Chicago area, essentially, that these urban areas have a lot of infrastructure that's outdated and they're overbuilt. There's too much concrete and not enough green
space.
And
that's been consistent, right?
This has been very consistent. Yeah. But really, you know, Brett also just touched on doing your part, clearing debris from your streets, getting a rain basin if you can. Small steps that you can take, you know, here in Chicago or in the burbs to sort of alleviate some of this flooding. You can read about it, wbez.org/flooding.
News you can use.
Absolutely.
For sure. Summer, from flooding to the Chicago River, briefly tell us about the Sounds of the River contest.
So this is a more exciting piece of news, but the Friends of the Chicago River, Solidarity Studios, and Planet Chombo have collabed to create a contest that sheds light on some of the positive infrastructures done and made to the Chicago River. They're using sounds of the river from the river itself, but also birds, toads, sounds of the train to create sample packs. And they're challenging Chicagoans to remix these sample packs to create new songs and music.
Toad Beach. Which,
yeah. You know, it sounds fun. And I've listened to a couple of sample packs.
Nice.
They're really fun. So they just had round one, which opened up last fall and closed this April. And round two opens May 2nd. So Chicagoans can go and use some of those sounds from the sample pack and truly remix it, have fun with it. And along the summer, they will announce winners and potentially even have a little showcase as well. So, yeah, pretty
fun.
That's
very cool. Claire, over to sports here. The NFL draft, it starts tonight. There's also a movement, though, in Springfield around keeping the Bears here in our state. The very latest on
this. Yeah, the Bears have the 26th pick. or 25th in the draft. So the bigger news this morning is certainly what Illinois lawmakers did last night, working to keep the Bears out of Indiana. The Illinois House just okayed a measure that would give the Bears property tax certainty. So this is on this potential build in Arlington Heights. It would also give some relief to suburban homeowners that live near the stadium. So this measure allowing the Bears to negotiate what would be a long-term freeze on property tax assessments on that stadium, while also directing those funds toward a property tax relief, like I said, near homeowners near the stadium. But also it would maybe propose a cut for property tax relief statewide. They're trying to sort of fit that one in. And latest move to sort of keep them out of Hammond, legislation is now moving to the state Senate. So certainly more to
the whiplash I'm getting from this story.
It's wild.
Where will they be? Real quick, what else are you following?
This was just kind of an interesting story. U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents intercepted a dead monkey. This was from a traveler's luggage at O'Hare earlier this month. A statement from CPB says a bizarre cargo was actually discovered during an X-ray. Obviously, that would cause potential for significant human health concerns. The monkey remains were detained and destroyed, all in accordance with governing agency directives.
I have so many questions, but I'm going to leave
you
alone.
We're leaving it there.
Yep. John, let's get to something else that's really big on your beat.
Sure.
A Cook County Circuit Court judge set to hear arguments over whether a special prosecutor should be assigned to target ICE and Border Patrol agents who may have broken the law in the county. And so a coalition of elected officials, clergy, journalists, attorneys, they've been pushing for a special prosecutor. The group argues that Cook County State's Attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke turned a blind eye to the federal violence that we saw. What should we expect tomorrow?
Well, you're going to hear arguments. Unclear if we'll get a ruling right away, but you're going to hear arguments that I really think revolve around prosecutorial discretion. You know, prosecutors have discretion to bring and pursue the cases they want to take, versus this argument that the state's attorney has kind of abdicated her role. Mm-hmm. And as you said, this coalition of elected officials, community members, journalists say that she has turned this blind eye, has really refused to take the lead on investigating these agents. They've argued various points of potential conflict. Originally, they argued that she may just fear retaliation from the Trump administration.
Oh.
So you're going to hear a lot of back and forth about that. State's Attorney Burke insists that, I mean, first of all, she has recently criticized the Trump administration. She says she's bound by the law. She wants to do this the right way, and that what the coalition is pushing could actually thwart justice.
Yeah, and she says, you know, and has always maintained that she didn't have the legal authority to do anything, right, to prosecute these federal agents. But you have details from an email that sheds a little bit more light?
Well, it speaks to the conflict. So so there were the original arguments made by the petitioners. She pushed back. She said that they hadn't pointed to any specific conflict. And now the coalition has come forward with an email from August. So this was in the weeks leading up to Operation Midway Blitz. But it was also the day, if you recall, there was first the controversy about the National Guard, and as we talked about earlier, whether
the
National Guard would be deployed into Chicago. So it was the day President Trump threatened to deploy the Guard into Chicago, and there was some effort among county officials to have everyone sign on to a joint statement pushing back against the Trump administration. And Eileen O'Neill Burke, spokesperson at the time, wrote a note declining to participate, saying that her priority is combating guns.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, she wants to maintain her excellent working relationships with the ATF and other federal partners. So now this coalition is pointing to that email as evidence that there is a conflict, that she couldn't even bring herself to sign on to a statement criticizing the Trump administration. Why would she go forward with the prosecution of some of these federal agents?
Mm.
That's what's being put forward. We're going to hear more about that tomorrow.
Interesting. And I want to be clear before we wrap, John.
Sure.
I mentioned that some journalists were part of the coalition calling for this special prosecutor. That includes some Sun-Times staff who are part of the Chicago News Guild. But you nor your editors are not involved in this litigation, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Nope. Not involved.
All right. WBEZ's Claire Lane and Summer Van Benton and John Seidel with the Sun-Times.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Micah Yason, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.